today.
We have breaking news on this Tuesday. Per Global Golf Post's Ron Green Jr., LIV Golf will not receive official World Golf ranking points as the OWGR has turned down the organization's formal request. This quote from the OWGR chairman Peter Dawson in a letter to LIV Golf CEO Greg Norman. The board committee met recently to again review your OWGR submission in light of your latest responses to the committee's questions and concerns. At the meeting, the board committee unanimously determined that at this time, the LIV Tour will not be recognized as an eligible golf tour in the OWGR system. Then we have this quote from Peter Dawson to the Global Golf Post. This is entirely technical. OWGR has no hostility toward LIV whatsoever. The important point is this is not about the players. LIV players are self-evidently good enough to be ranked. There is no doubt about that. This is about should a tour whose formats are so different and whose qualification criteria are so different, can they be ranked equitably with other tours who conform to the OWGR norm and have more competition to them than perhaps the closed shop that is LIV. Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post broke this story, and he joins us now. Ron, we appreciate your time. What are the nuts and bolts of this story in your mind?
Well, I think you hit on them right there, that they have, for the time being, denied LIV points. You know, we go back when this whole thing started. One of the selling points for LIV Golf was you're going to be able to get World Golf ranking points. Actually, they did not technically apply for those until after their second event last year. There have been numerous conversations between Greg Norman, Peter Dawson, and others about this. And, you know, it's sort of been out there kind of quiet now, waiting on this decision. I think the thing that struck me was in Peter Dawson's letter to Greg Norman and Gary Davidson, and in the conversation this morning, he sort of struck a conciliatory tone, like, this is not the way we want it to be, but under our guidelines, as he said, this is a technical thing. They don't qualify. And he sort of laid out ways that this could be rectified in the future, that they'll feel free to bring back another solution, or, you know, if you make some changes, we'll look at them. But for the time being, it's the status quo.
And Ron, some of the concerns Peter Dawson specified are, they're mostly around format and the idea of no cut and the qualification process by which people enter and leave the LIV Golf ecosystem. But he also mentioned the idea of individual and team competitions being conducted side by side and the difficulty of reconciling that with the rankings. That wouldn't seem like something that's immediately fixable if you're Greg Norman. They've really kind of nailed their colors to the mast in terms of this is the way they want it to run.
Yeah, as Peter said, there's a way to mathematically take the format, the 54 holes and no cut and all that, and make it work in their system. But it's the other things, how team competition might impact how an individual plays. That is a big deal to them. It's not like anything else to deal with that. That gets in the way, as does the fact that, you know, you have players who are under contract. Certain players, it doesn't matter how they, in his words, underperform, they're still going to be there. There's no relegation for them. And the pathway in is really limited. You know, some of it could be just contractual. Some, there are three or four spots that can be open. I think they want to see more of that. As Dawson said, you know, there's thousands of players every week trying to get a spot in a tournament that would qualify for World Golf ranking points. And then to suddenly just have your structure set up so that no matter what you do, you're not going to, you're still going to keep playing. That does not work in the equation there. And I think that is the biggest sticking point at this point, is my sense.
Ron, in light of the framework agreement between LIV Golf, the PGA Tour, and DP World Tour, in light of the fact that Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the PIF chairman, played golf last week at the Alfred Dunhill Links with Martin Slumbers, CEO of the R&A, with Peter Dawson Thursday and Friday, respectively, is any part of you surprised that LIV Golf was denied official World Golf ranking points?
I think they went very much by their handbook and by their rules. You know, Keith Pelley and Jay Monahan were not part of this discussion or decision. I might be surprised if they didn't have a sense that this was coming, that they, I'm sure, because they had asked the question. I think there's a lot in the game is in flux right now. Talking to Peter, he said, you know, there are actually some PGA Tour events, the formats that they're talking about for next year, they want to take a look at themselves. But I think if we get this agreement to the next step, then everything changes again. As Peter Dawson said, we understand change and we want to be flexible. He said it diminishes the rankings if Bryson DeChambeau and Dustin Johnson are not where they should be. But that's the way it works right now. So they don't see this as a way, they can't do it right now, but they have given them at least a hint or, you know, an idea of how to move forward. And again, 3 months from now, if there's a total agreement, we're entering this whole new realm of professional golf, that just changes what they have to deal with.
Ron, we've heard very little from Greg Norman ever since the announcement on June 6th of that framework agreement. Liv is playing this week in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. What do you expect the reaction is going to be on the ground over there to this news?
Well, they've been pretty outspoken in saying how unjust they think it is, and I would expect their disappointment will be amplified with this. Again, I don't know if they had a sense it was coming, but they have, they have heralded this since the outset, since they actually began playing, that this was all part of what was going to make them special. And, they're going to be part of the ecosystem. And as much as they've tried, I think this is a big point of it. And they're still on the outside looking in. I mean, again, Peter Dawson said, there's a lot of good things about progress in golf and finding different formats and looking at the game in a little different light. And, he sort of encouraged that, but it doesn't work for what we're doing here to include those players. So I'm sure there will be a lot of guys who are really disappointed. There'll probably be some pretty sharp comments. And again, when they get back, I guess Miami is next week for the season finale. Here in the States, there'll be more questions and comments about it. So again, I don't think they're surprised, but I'm sure they're very disappointed.
And lots still to be determined, as we know. Ron, great reporting. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Folks, take a look at the LIV Golf OWGR timeline. You'll recall it was last summer that LIV Golf submitted the application to receive official World Golf ranking points. In fact, at the time last year, the entire roster of LIV golfers wrote a letter to Peter Dawson calling for world ranking points to be awarded immediately and retroactively to June, saying LIV without rankings is like college football without the SEC or the Big Ten or Argentina, Belgium, and England. Not eligible for FIFA. August of 2022, Greg Norman writes a letter to LIV players that OWGR is severely compromised without LIV's inclusion. October, LIV forms strategic alliance with Middle East and North Africa Tour in effort to secure official World Golf ranking points. December of 2022, the OWGR announces that Mexican Professional Golf Tour will begin to earn points in January of 2023. LIV status still undetermined. Then in May of this year, Seth Waugh says OWGR and LIV have been collegial in their discussions, although OWGR hadn't heard from LIV in weeks. And then October, LIV's application for OWGR points is turned down. That broken today by Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post. And this from Peter Dawson, the OWGR chairman, on the future. If LIV could find a way to come up with more open competition style and relegation, we would certainly consider that. There should be many more vacancies than perhaps there are. I don't think it's fair to the other 24 eligible tours and the thousands of players trying to get a start each week. Eamon, your thoughts on this breaking news? Maybe a bit of a surprise considering this framework agreement and where we thought perhaps LIV Golf was going.
Well, I think it's important that the official World Golf ranking were to be seen to be outside of that framework agreement. And the notable parties to that agreement, Jay Monahan, Keith Pelly, had recused themselves from any decision-making in this. But it really is a formal notification, as it were, that Greg Norman sold these guys a bill of goods. Everything he's told them was a lie. Every single thing. He told them they could cherry pick PGA Tour events. The court said no. He told them that they could play DP World Tour events. A tribunal over there said no. He told them that they would be hailed as visionaries. Public opinion certainly said no on that one. He told them he could play all the majors. The majors said that's not happening. And he told them they would have world ranking points. That's not happening either. And the Saudis are very accustomed to waiving whatever rules or customs or standards don't suit them, certainly as it relates to human rights and extrajudicial murders. But on official world golf ranking points, They are simply being told they will not debase the system of the ranking simply to accommodate business decisions that individual players have made.
I don't think anyone's going to argue that Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, Bryson DeChambeau are still not, you know, three of the best players in the world of golf. But for those players that are on the outside that are not major championship eligible, like those three players, what's their recourse? Where do they go from here? Do they have to just wait to see what this framework agreement ultimately bears?
Which will in itself be separate from LIV Golf. I mean, it's very clear. Greg Norman was very clear at the outset that they would not change the format from the team event. They would not change the ecosystem.
Right.
Really, guys get into that ecosystem, the 48-man fields, on the whim of Greg Norman. There really is not a qualification mechanism in, and as Ron Green just pointed out, that some people are contractually exempt from being relegated out of it for poor play. So that was always going to be a tough sell in terms of this. You're going to hear players say, well, if the ranking doesn't show Dustin Johnson in the top 10 in the world, it's unfair. It's nonsense. Dustin Johnson is exactly where he needs to be in the world ranking now because Dustin Johnson is bearing the result of the business decision that he happened to make. These guys think that the rules ought to be rewritten or ignored simply to accommodate the business decision they chose to make with full clarity on what the possible consequences are. Now they're being told to pound sand and they're not going to like it.
Do you think this was a close call for the OWGR, a difficult decision when you think of the fact that the elements required to get official world golf ranking points, you have to have a 36-hole cut, for example, the field size an average of 75, a system of Monday qualifying. LIV Golf falls short in so many of those elements.
There's a technical argument here and there's a political argument here, and you can see Peter Dawson in his letter trying to straddle both. In fact, he said last week in an interview at the Dunhill Links when he played with Yasser Al-Rumayyan of the Public Investment Fund that Yasser is bringing a lot of money into the game and that ought to be embraced and welcomed. Well, there's a lot of people don't actually think that it ought to be embraced and welcomed, but certainly that is the reality and what looks to be the reality going forward with all of the tours. So Peter Dawson's straddling that line, but on their own published criteria, it was very difficult, borderline impossible, for the official World Golf Rankings to contort itself to be able to accommodate the way LIV Golf goes. And I keep going back to the LIV event in Orlando, back just before the Masters. Sebastian Munoz, in an interview after it, he was one stroke behind Brooks Koepka on the 18th green and said he did not aggressively go for a birdie putt, which would have tied Brooks, because he had a one-stroke lead in the team event and he was protecting that. So when you have these kind of team considerations that are undermining the credibility of individual competition, it's awfully hard to treat that seriously, much less figure out how it could be equitably ranked against other tours where players aren't doing that.
Yeah, LIV Golf has the players. They don't have the format. You said from the outset that Greg Norman would not change, would not contort LIV Golf, change the format, 54 holes, shotgun start, no cut. Can you envision a scenario where LIV Golf does bend its own format, bend its own rules to more comply with what the OWGR is asking for?
I don't see it happening imminently, and it's very unclear what the future of LIV Golf is under this framework agreement, and it's very unlikely that the framework agreement will be consummated into a definitive deal before the end of this year, which was their initial deadline. That's most likely to happen well into next year, based on conversations I've had with people. But the actual future of LIV Golf beyond 2024 would probably be determined by what happens in that definitive agreement. And if there is no definitive agreement and LIV continues on its own in its own ecosystem, then they may be more inclined to actually change formats to try to make it a valid tour under the World Golf Rankings. And in fairness, as much as I despise the sourcing of the money, if they meet the criteria, they ought to be given the points. The problem is they don't meet the criteria and think they ought to be getting the points anyway.
From your reporting, and we've heard Brooks Koepka on Netflix talk about the injuries he faced, the reasons for his decisions on leaving the PGA Tour and going to LIV. In light of a day like today with the news, with LIV Golf being denied official World Golf Ranking points, do you think there are other players beyond Brooks Koepka in your reporting and conversations that are second-guessing their decision?
I'm not even sure Brooks Koepka is second-guessing his decision. He's proven that given limited opportunity against the other best players in the world, he can accumulate enough points to remain in the top 20 in the official World Golf Ranking now and play his way into other major championships.
And win, as he's proven as well.
Exactly, but there are other players who don't have the life raft that he has or that a Phil Mickelson has, other guys who've earned that status going forward. I think it's going to be tough for those guys to play their way back, because ultimately they're a shutout of the two main tours where points can be accumulated. Yeah. And now they find themselves, as Graham McDowell has recently, you're playing in Singapore and other places where there aren't that many points at stake to begin with. And trying to play well in smaller events to try to accumulate enough points to keep yourself relevant. But ultimately, it's a decision that these guys have made, and they're kind of locked into now.
The PGA Tour was the home for a lot of these players for many, many years. You have to wonder maybe if the PGA Tour will be a life raft for some of these players who are starving for official World Golf Ranking points.
Well, whether or not they're welcome on that life raft is going to remain to be seen, I guess, in the coming months. Well, the LPGA Tour is also making news this week, thousands of miles away in Shanghai, but one of its biggest stars is headlining here at home in Las Vegas. Lexi Thompson is in the field at the PGA Tour event, Shriners Children's Open. More on that when we come back. This week, the tour heads west to TPC Summerlin in Las Vegas, Nevada for the Shriners Children's Open. Tom King is defending his title, and LPGA player Lexi Thompson is set to become the seventh woman to compete on the PGA Tour. Lexi was given a sponsor's exemption into the tournament and will become the first woman to play a tour event since Brittany Lincecum missed the cut at the 2018 Barbasol Championship. Thompson's coming off a solo fifth finish last week on the LPGA Tour at the Ascendant LPGA, benefiting Volunteers of America. And she joins a notable list of women who have competed on the PGA Tour, headed by Michelle Wee West, who did it eight times, the great Babe Didrikson-Zaharias did it seven times and is the best finish by any woman on the PGA Tour, 33rd in Phoenix back in 1945. But a lot of Hall of Fame names there, Damon, Annika Sorenstam, Shirley Spork. I mean, what do you think, in terms of, let's put it in the historical context first, what's the value or meaning of Lexi Thompson playing this week in Vegas?
I think it's significant. I hope she embraces it, that she's playful, enjoys it, because I think there was a time when there would be more pushback against a woman playing on the PGA Tour, and it's not that long ago. You go back to 2003, for example, when Annika Sorenstam competed against the men at Colonial. Vijay Singh was very, very vociferous against it. He told the Associated Press at the time, "I hope she misses the cut. Why? Because she doesn't belong out here. If I'm drawn with her, which I won't be, I won't play." Vijay later tried to clarify, saying, "Well, I want her to miss the cut because I don't want to finish behind her." Tried to clean it up, but the damage was done. I feel like in this era, we're more used to this. We saw Michelle Wee do this several times. Babe Didrikson-Zaharias did it. Susie Whaley did it here outside of our offices in Cromwell, Connecticut. So this is not something new, but I do think that the tenor, the tone, much more positive than we even had 20 years ago.
Does it matter how she plays in that historical context then?
I don't think it matters how she plays as much as it matters how she embraces it. There'll be some eyeballs, and I'm sure there's some quiet critics that are wondering how she's going to do. She has not played very well on the LPGA Tour over the past couple of seasons. No victories, though she has played very well of late, a couple of top tens in her last starts on the LPGA, 3-1 at the Solheim Cup. But I'm sure there are some old school folks that maybe don't want to see her out there. I think it's more about the smile, embracing it, poking fun. You'll remember Annika Sorenstam. She missed the cut as well, but it was hailed as a victory because she was self-deprecating. She was approachable. She had this moment here on her opening tee shot where she grabs the tee, she got a little exhale there, had some fun with it. And it became a story that we embraced because this was one of the great champions who just wanted to measure herself against the men, learn where she needed to improve from a competitive standpoint. And she went on to, of course, win, what, 8-9 times in 2004, had a fantastic 04, 05, 06, in large part, she says, because she tested herself against the men in 2003 at Colonial. I hope Lexi takes that same spirit this week.
I think you're right about the tenor changing on all of this stuff as well, and it's not as though the reaction to it is necessarily critical, but it is acknowledging a reality here. And Peter Malnati is on the PGA Tour's board. He was asked about this last week, and here's what Peter had to say.
Obviously, I know that Lexi at times has been one of the top players on the LPGA Tour, and she's obviously very athletic. Distance won't be a problem. She'll hit it far enough. My gut reaction when I saw that was like, you know, the tournament kind of reaching to try to drum up interest. And I think I think I understand that, if that is the case. I don't think we're going to need to resort to gimmicks to drum up interest. And I shouldn't have said that. I don't know that, you know, having Lexi play is a gimmick. But I don't think the tournaments are going to have to go to those kind of lengths to drum up interest and get storylines that they can sell. Because I think these events are actually going to have a lot of meaning. And I think, you know, I like I said, change is hard for everyone at every level. So I assume, you know, if you're a host organization of a tournament, if you're the Century Club here in Jackson, if you're Wayne Sanderson Farms, you just don't know right now for sure what you have anymore because, you know, the fall is completely reimagined. I'm pretty sure that the fall is going to be a blockbuster hit. I think it's going to be very successful. But these tournaments, they don't know yet. And so having Lexi play certainly will get a lot of headlines. And, you know, if that's the goal for Shriners and the host organization in Vegas there, that's great. And, you know, she's obviously a professional athlete. She's accomplished a lot. Like, it's not like, you know, I mean, who knows what'll happen. She may go play really well and it may be huge. She may play absolutely terrible and, you know, finish 132nd. Either way, like, she's a professional golfer. She has a spot in the field. The tournament's, you know, if it gets them the attention that they want and it works out positively for them, great. All for it.
I thought that was a pretty thoughtful response from Peter Malnati there in terms of what the reality is of tournaments trying to get some attention here. And I've always been a huge advocate of tournaments being given extreme latitude when it comes to sponsor invitations. It's really one of the few ways in which they can impact the narrative of the tournament that they're putting millions and millions of dollars into. In the context that we are in now with the fall events and all of these guys playing for their cards, it adds an extra wrinkle. So you're going to hear some griping about that. And if you are one of those players who's not in the field this week, there's a couple of potential reasons for that. We've seen some social media criticism this week on the criteria the tour uses to allow guys to play this week, including going by where they are on the FedEx Cup points list from last year while they're fighting for their livelihoods this year. Aaron Baddeley, who's barely outside the top 100 in the FedEx Cup points list, he can't qualify for the field this week. Dylan Wu, again, high up on that list, can't get into the field this week. But if you're a guy who thinks that Lexi Thompson being in the field is the difference between you having a tour card or not, play that.
Yeah.
It's really just that simple. And to me, the big thing this week is what Peter Malnati just alluded to there, is how she performs isn't really important. How she reacts to how she performs is important because she's got a poor advice system around her. And we see that constantly in press conferences with Lexi when she's had a bad day. We saw it most recently at the Solheim Cup. It's reluctance to answer questions about a difficult moment on the golf course. And that's par for the course. That's what you do as a professional golfer. And there are great times when you stand up there and everything's going well. There are times when it's not going well, and Lexi has shown a reluctance to face it when it's not going well.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I agree with you. She needs to handle it better. You could tell during that tough moment at the Solheim Cup, she hit the poor chip and she kind of said, that's not a great question. I don't have to answer that. And then Stacey Lewis, the captain, kind of came to her defense and said, what a bad question from Alex Maselli. I don't think it was a bad question. I think it was a tough question. And that's why I'm saying I hope Lexi embraces the spotlight that will be on her this week, good, bad, or ugly. I hope she has fun with this week because that's what you should do as a sponsor's exemption with a great opportunity to play inside the ropes on the PGA Tour.
And the fact that we're talking about it this much earlier in the week proves that it was already a successful decision by the tournament organizers to have Lexi there. If she plays well, even better.
Yeah.
Her presence there is a boon to this tournament one way or the other.
Arguably the biggest story of this week. Still to come was a special week last week on the Korn Ferry Tour. 30 players locked up their PGA Tour cards for 2024. We catch up with the Pepperdine alum, Joe Highsmith, who is tour bound. Nice hat.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Top of the hour, breaking news on this Tuesday. LIV Golf will not receive official World Golf ranking points as the OWGR has turned down the organization's formal request. This OWGR sending a letter to LIV Golf today. The CEO, Greg Norman, saying in part, the board committee met recently to again review your OWGR submission in light of your latest responses to the committee's questions and concerns.
At the meeting, the board committee unanimously determined that at this time, the LIV Tour will not be recognized as an eligible golf tour in the OWGR system. And more on this news later in the show as our own Rex Hager joins to break down what this means.
Well, the 2023 Korn Ferry Tour season concluded Sunday afternoon with the Korn Ferry Tour Championship presented by United Leasing and Finance. Paul Barjon won for the second time this season, moved from number 45 to number 8 in the Korn Ferry Tour points list to lock up his spot in the top 30 and a return to the PGA Tour. The top 30 players on the Korn Ferry Tour points list earned that PGA Tour card for the 2024 season, which for the latest group of Korn Ferry Tour graduates begins in January at the Sony Open in Hawaii. And one of those guys who's tour bound is Pepperdine alum Joe Highsmith.
Eamon, a couple years ago, Highsmith hit one of the best shots of the year, beat Oklahoma State's Aman Gupta on the 18th hole at Greyhawk to send Pepperdine to the NCAA final. Did so thanks in large part to this fairway bunker shot. Touch heavy in the water, touch thin, he'd probably catch the bunker lip. He hit it perfectly to 8 feet and calmly lagged close for the concession. I tell you what, a fantastic bio, a great celebration for the Waves who went on to win. He recorded 10 top 25s, 4 top 10s in the Korn Ferry Tour among his 20 starts, won 3 times during his college career at Pepperdine. Great campus there, Malibu, right there on the water. Played in 4 straight U.S. amateurs from 18 to 21. Made the second round of match play in 21 and claims he's better at pickleball than he is at golf. More on that in just a bit. Joe Highsmith joins us now. Congratulations on being tour bound. You were outside that top 30 number going into the last 2 events. Then you go T2, T3. What was the key?
Oh, man, I don't know. There are probably a lot of different things that I was battling, trying to work out those last couple weeks. But I would say the key was just, I mean, doing my best to stay calm and commit to my shots under by far the most pressure I've ever felt both those weeks. So I'm just so happy I got it done.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, Joe, you were 48th in that points list. You just crept into the top 30 heading into the Tour Championship. What was the stress level like for you that week? How much was it on your mind? And were you able to separate the long-term consequences from the short-term shots you were trying to hit?
Yeah, I think I did a great job of that on the weekend. I would say Thursday, Friday, I was well aware of where I stood and how the leaderboard was looking. Like, pretty much everyone that was right behind me on the points list was at the top of the leaderboard. So, very stressful, but I think come Saturday, Sunday, I kind of tried to turn the blinders on and just focus on my game. And, you know, obviously everyone says it, but just do your best to know you can't control what other guys are doing. And all you can do is go out there and play your best and hope that all finishes up well. And fortunately it did.
You have said one of your favorite things in sports is the feeling of a flush golf shot. How many times per round would you say you actually hit it flush on the screws exactly how you want to?
Gosh, not many. I know I've heard some legends of the game say it's only maybe a couple per tournament, and I would probably agree with that. It's like tournament golf and playing under pressure. You're really just trying your best to manage whatever game you have, and it's pretty rare that you have a day that you just can't miss and are hitting those kinds of golf shots. And I would say most of the last couple tournaments, although I did play well, for a shot like that, it's still pretty rare. So I kind of managed my misses a lot and really didn't hit a ton of perfectly flush shots, but was able to get the ball in the hole.
Should try hitting it on the club face where we hit it, Joe, and see how well you do. In that scenario, you made your way onto the Korn Ferry Tour through the PGA Tour University rankings. Adrian de Montfichassert, who's also going to the tour from the Korn Ferry Tour, also made it through the same way. Is that an endorsement of how that program works in terms of developing college talent? And is it a sign of how college talent these days is so ready to compete on the PGA Tour right out of school?
I think so, without a doubt. I mean, when I turned pro, I was in the PGA Tour Canada category for PGAU, and I played up there, and I was pretty happy with how I did on that tour and how a couple other guys from the PGAU program had done right out of school. And then this year, all these guys come out of college and they're winning in their first couple starts on the Korn Ferry Tour. So I think that program is pretty amazing. I mean, I've been one to benefit from it. Obviously, these other guys have as well. And they've proven without a doubt over the last couple of years that these guys are ready to play. And I just think it's great.
Speaking of young stars ready to play, Joe, I'm going to level with you. I was up early watching Ben Shelton and Yannick Sinner battle in Shanghai. I read that you're a big fan of tennis, Gail Monfils, Nick Kyrgios. Where is your love with the racket sports, tennis, pickleball, et cetera?
Gosh, I don't know. I think it's that one of my friends has a pickleball court here, so I've been playing that since I was pretty young. And I recently just got into tennis in the last couple of years or so, but I don't know what it is. I mean, I think that those are some of the funnest sports to play. I enjoy probably playing tennis and pickleball more than I would say golf. Obviously, it's different. It's more of a fun versus a kind of what I've done forever, but I have so much fun playing. And yeah, I will say the pickleball thing that I've heard a lot lately about me saying I'm better at that than golf, I'm not sure where that came from. I probably said that when I was joking somewhere, but it's definitely not true, obviously. But I do love pickleball. I love tennis as well. I think those are some of the most, yeah, entertaining things to do and to watch.
Are you a goal setter, Joe? Have you had time yet? I know it's only been a couple of days, but have you had time to set what realistic objectives for you are on the PGA Tour next year?
I don't really think so. I'm not a huge goal setter. I would say my goals, rather than being on a results side, I'm just trying to go out there and play my game as well as I can and do really the same things that I've done that have led to success in college and obviously on the PGA Tour Canada and Korn Ferry Tour as well. And I kind of think that the more that I can just try to do my best with the stuff that I know works and continue to just get better at that, then the results will come. I don't have many expectations regarding keeping my card or getting a top 70 or potentially having a chance to win in my rookie year. I'm just really trying to do the same stuff that I've seen work and kind of see where it puts me. I don't know what to expect. Obviously, this will be, I've played one PGA Tour event and one, I played the US Open as well. So I've only had really two events with those guys. And both times I felt like if I was playing well, I could be able to do pretty well. But yeah, I'm kind of trying to pretty much have no expectations and just really see what my good can get me out there.
Well, you got your fellow Pepperdine alum, Sahith Theegala, waiting for you. I hope you bring the bucket hat as well, and best of luck in 2024.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me on.
All right, he is Joe Highsmith. On the other side of the break, we're catching up with our friend and 11-time PGA Tour winner, John Cook. We'll take a walk down memory lane as he recalls his win at the Shriners. It's Vegas week, baby. Vegas! Back on Golf Today, another day, another video of the 15-time major champion Tiger Woods hitting balls, this time at Monterey Peninsula Country Club for the TW Invitational, using the bounce, making the golf ball dance. My goodness, Big Cat looking good. And who are those guys with Michael Block? I think it's Tiger and Max Homa, Stanford and Cal together, hanging out with one of the stars of the PGA Championship at Oak Hill, where that major turned into a block party, Eamon, that has not stopped.
Speaking of Tiger, he's been stuck on 82 PGA Tour wins for a few years, but number one came in Las Vegas all the way back in 1996. First victory on the PGA Tour, he beat Davis Love III in a playoff that week. And of course, he is first among equals when it comes to the notable list of past champions of the Shriners Children's Open, which began all the way back in 1983. Fuzzy Zeller, the first winner, and you see others are Davis Love, more recently Patrick Cantlay and Tom Kim.
Speaking of this week's tour stop, let's flash back to 1992. Our friend and colleague John Cook won three times on tour that year, including his win at the Shriners, finished the week at 26 under, two shots clear of David Frost, who shot 63. And Cookie, 11-time winner on tour, 10-time winner on PGA Tour Champions, owns top five finishes at the PGA, the Open, the U.S. Open, member of the 93 victorious U.S. Ryder Cup team, and attended the Ohio State University as we gear up for a past champ chat. And John Cook joins us now from Trinity Forest. Cookie, great to see you. 1992, Vegas was your third win of the season, joining Fred Couples and Davis Love III. You also surpassed $1 million in earnings a la Couples and Love. How much was that a talking point in 1992? How much money you won and how often you won?
Well, the problem is I might have won that much, but I spent at least double of that. So, back in those days, it was make a dollar, spend two. But it was a great time in my life, my golfing life. Obviously, it was the best season that I'd had, prior and, probably since. As far as that goes. So to win in Las Vegas kind of just put a cap on the year of a really good year with three wins, three seconds. Two of those were in majors, top three on the money list, and that my Open Championship money didn't even count, wasn't even official money. So I don't know how close I would have gotten to Fred and Davis, but it was really a special year. I worked really hard after an injury coming back in 1989, in 90, 91. It all kind of took shape in 92.
John, that was your first victory after that near miss in the Open Championship at Muirfield. This might be a very dumb question, but does that actually ease the sting of coming close to the claret jug, or do they live in two very separate universes?
Eamon, I'd won a bit in my career, so I was ready to take that next step. I thought I always had a game to win major championships. That Open Championship was a bitter disappointment. It still stings today, honestly. But even later that year, even with a second at the PGA at Belle Reve to Nick Price, that one still hurt. But to validate a nice season with another win and get three wins on the year, I can be very, very proud of 1992 and what I accomplished and where I took everything to that next level.
Did you feel as though the Vegas tournament owed you one? Because 2 years earlier, at a different golf course, you'd been in a playoff with Bob Tway, and a bit of a dramatic ending that didn't quite go your way.
Yeah, it did. Where I flew a shot into the cup on the first playoff hole and end up losing the playoff, and that was kind of my comeback year in 1990. So I had a nice run through Las Vegas. My father was the tournament director for a number of years. So it always meant something very, very special to our family, going to Las Vegas, being part of that community. Also, playing well in one of my father's events. A little bit of more satisfaction to it. And we had everybody there. In fact, my wife threw me a birthday party on that Saturday night before the final round that I didn't even know about. It was a surprise party there at the Mirage. She had set it up. We had like 35 people in and busloads of people coming out to the tournament on Sunday, and friends and family were gathered around for the weekend. So to win in front of all those great special friends and family and in front of my dad was really, really special.
Yeah, your dad's the tournament director. You got this big party. Everybody's around. Your dad's handing you the trophy at the end of the day. How'd you compartmentalize that and not kind of look too far ahead into the future and kind of keep your eye on the ball, as it were?
It was very interesting. My mind was so far away from golf on that evening because, my family, my kids showed up, during that day. And all I could talk to my son Jason about was he scored six goals in a soccer game earlier that day. So, you kind of put things back in perspective, and you're a father, you're a husband, you're a friend. Last thing on my mind really was maybe a three-shot lead going into Sunday. It kind of put things in perspective and kind of knocked me back down onto, husband, father, friend level. And so when I went out on Sunday morning, I was so relaxed and ready to play. And I think I might have birdied my first hole, and I just said, man, this is mine. Keep your eye on the prize. You know what? We'll have hugs and kisses when we're done, but I got a job to do right now for the next 4 hours, and I took care of business.
Back in 92, John, the Tour Championship ended the season in October. Vegas was pretty late on that schedule. What do you make of the current fall series now? Do you feel as though the events at this time of the year are in any way diminished or were diminished during that kind of wraparound schedule, or do they actually have more of an identity now than they've had in recent years?
I've gone back and forth on this, Eamon, to tell you the truth, and you know, we kind of like that schedule. I know that it's up against the NFL and college football. I get that, but you know, these events right now, they have purpose. They have meanings to these communities that support these events at this time of year. So I feel for these events. I know my father was part of these events, and understanding what, you know, this community involvement means to these events, you know, and their foundations. So I would like to see these, you know, these events, you know, keep a place on the schedule, keep purpose on the schedule. Also, you know, going back to this year's Ryder Cup, I don't think our team was very well prepared to play. They hadn't played golf in 5 weeks, except for Max Homa and Justin Thomas. So, you know, I think that there's a place on the schedule for these events going forward. And I just hope that there's some sort of happy medium that comes out of this, because they are very, very special events to these communities.
Cookie, you brought up the Ryder Cup, so why don't we keep talking about that? You were on the last American team to win on foreign soil. How much does that, you know, give you a pit in your stomach, and is a tough point for you when you look at all these years that have gone by and all of the losses that the American team has incurred?
Yeah, it was a hard watch, to tell you the truth, Damon. It's difficult. I love the Ryder Cup. You know, being part of that 93 team was so special to me in a, you know, very, very different sense than where my professional career had gone. So, you know, being part of that team was, we still talk about it. I see Lanny Watkins all the time. I talk to, you know, Lee Jansen all the time. I talk to, you know, Fred and Azinger. And, you know, we really have a special bond right there. You know, being part of that team and to see what's going on now is really heartbreaking. There's no real rhyme or reason for it. It's just, you know, they're kind of in a bad spot, you know, when they get to Europe. Just as, you know, Europe, when they come to the United States, it's just such a, you know, it's not that the players don't care. I don't buy that. They care maybe a lot, maybe too much sometimes. But it just hasn't been the, you know, the right time in getting everybody on the same page and playing, you know, well together at the same time, the way that the Europeans kind of bind and find themselves, you know, just at the tops of their games at the right time. So it's a timing thing. But, yeah, going back, you know, over 30 years now for a last win on European soil, it's going to have to wait another couple years. So we'll have to wait and see how that all plays out when we go back across the pond.
You played for Tom Watson on that team back in 93. He was also the captain in 14 at Glen Eagles, John. He was a guy who famously called his own shots without fear or favour as a captain. That worked in 93. Some people say it didn't in 14. Have things gotten too pally-pally on the US team right now? Does the captain give too much weight to players who want to play with people who make them comfortable? And is it time for a captain who has a little bit more of Watson in him?
I believe so, Eamon. And, you know, who doesn't love Zach Johnson? I know that. But, you know, clearly something going to Europe is not working. And Tom Watson had one assistant captain, Stan Thirsk, his teacher at the time. So it wasn't like he had other players and other players involved, except his two picks were Raymond Floyd and Lanny Watkins, who, you know, they acted as captains in that team room. You know, great experience, great to bounce things off, feelings, how you're feeling. Right now, it's hard. You know, I know they have the task force. I know they have a lot of people involved, but I think it's you appoint a captain to be the captain, not delegate, you know, a bunch of different duties to different people. So maybe it is time to have, you know, a captain that serves as the captain for longer than you know, one cycle, and that could be his job, and to get better at his job and create a team that is going to bind together, you know, for one single purpose, and that's to win that Ryder Cup. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion, I'm sure, out there on what went wrong. I know in Italy they had a lot of past captains go over. So, you know, the team got to see, you know, the Lanny Watkins, Curtis Strange, Raymond Floyd was over there, Trevino, all the great captains that we've had, they were all over there, but they weren't really part of the actual team experience. So maybe they got to you know, get everybody together and get these guys, get their head spaces where they need to be, and something clearly needs to be done.
Well, Tiger Woods transcends different generations. Davis Love III basically said it's Tiger's job if he wants it. Was a victorious President's Cup captain. What would Tiger Woods bring to the table as captain at Bethpage in 2025?
Well, he'd certainly bring tons of respect, tons of knowledge, experience, both on the good side and the bad side. And he crosses generations. He's friends with the young kids, but he's also friends with the experienced veterans that he leaned on, you know, during his early days. So maybe he can bring a little bit of combination to that team room with, you know, young experience, not a lot of skeletons in the closet, and also older experiences on how to win and also how to lose. We've done all of it all together. So it would be he kind of just goes back and forth with the generations.
John, there's a lot of controversy in Rome about this idea of whether or not players ought to be paid for a Ryder Cup. And to be fair, it wasn't just a Rome conversation. This conversation has been around for many years at this point. Where do you fall on this idea? Do players deserve to be compensated beyond the charity dollars they get at the Ryder Cup, or should they be expected to play for free for 3 days every 2 years?
You know, that's such an interesting, dynamic and what's going on. Everybody that basically is over there for the PGA Tour, for the PGA of America, for, you know, the television networks and everybody else, they're all getting paid to go do, their job. So I certainly see the idea that was brought back in 1999 from Mark O'Meara, David Duval, and a host of others. Certainly understand the monetary aspects of it on who's making all the money and where it's all being distributed to. Charitable contributions are phenomenal. They're great. They've really helped a lot of our foundations and a lot of our, some of where our ties lie in those foundations and what we're doing for the charitable aspects of the world. So I'm not sure that they really actually want to be paid money, cash. Just they want a little bit more recognition on what they're doing and who's doing what, where that money is all going. I think that's a valid question.
Conversation that will no doubt continue up to Bethpage and perhaps beyond as well. Cookie, we always appreciate the time. Have a great week in Dallas.
We're having a blast. Jackson T. Stevens Cup is on its way and running, and we're happy to be part of it.
Golf Today.
In case you missed the breaking news on this Tuesday, LIV Golf will not receive official World Golf ranking points as OWGR has turned down the organization's formal request. OWGR sent a letter to LIV today, which said in part, "The board committee met recently to again review your OWGR submission in light of your latest responses to the committee's questions and concerns. At the meeting, the board committee unanimously determined that at this time, the LIV Tour will not be recognized as an eligible golf tour in the OWGR system." This quote to the Global Golf Post from the OWGR chairman, Peter Dawson. This is entirely technical. OWGR has no hostility toward LIV whatsoever. The important point is this is not about the players. LIV players are self-evidently good enough to be ranked. There's no doubt about that. This is about should a tour whose formats are so different and whose qualification criteria are so different, can they be ranked equitably with other tours who conform to the OWGR norm and have more competition to them than perhaps the closed shop that is LIV. For more, we welcome in GolfChannel.com senior writer Rex Hoggen. Rex, what's your reaction to this news?
Damon, I look at this two ways. First, in the micro, I don't think this was any big surprise. The concerns that were voiced in this letter today go back a year and a half ago when LIV Golf first applied for World Golf ranking points and the concerns that they had about format, limited fields with only 48 players, 54 holes. The team aspect of it made, obviously, the board uncomfortable and probably more so than anything you just mentioned, the closed shop concept. As of right now, according to Ron Green Jr.'s story on Global Golf Post, there's going to be 14 players who are guaranteed contracts next year on LIV Golf, regardless of how they perform on the golf course. I think that's always going to be a sticking point for the world ranking when you look at what their current regulations are. The other half of it is it's in the macro. And I think this is a bit of a surprise. I had one official during the Ryder Cup kind of explain to me that the ongoing negotiations for any type of definitive agreement between the PIF and the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour, if you look at it like an iceberg, what you can see above the water is only about 10% of what's going on. Right now, I think this letter is an indication of what's going on. You get an idea of where the current ecosystem is. I think last week, when the governor of the PIF played in the Dunhill alongside Peter Dawson for the World Golf Ranking, along with Martin Slumbers from the RNA, I think that's an indication. There's a lot of moving parts all below the water, and I think we're just now starting to see some of them.
Rex, the LIV guys have gathered this week in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia for their penultimate event of the season. Are you hearing any responses from the players who are out there yet?
I was texting back and forth with one LIV player, and there was no big surprise from him. He actually said the ship had really sailed in a lot of LIV players' minds when it comes to the World Golf Ranking. If you go back to the idea that those points that the players carried over with them from the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour to LIV Golf, it's been about a year and a half now, and they've almost all cycled out. And the way he explained it, their field has been decimated by this anyway, and there probably is no going back anyway when it comes to the World Ranking. His idea, and this has been brought up at least internally with LIV Golf, is that the four major championships, which is what this is kind of about, players trying to earn enough world ranking points to make sure they can get into the majors. If the major championships start looking at the LIV Golf Tour the way they maybe look at other tours, they allow maybe the top five players off their order of merit or their money list, that would open the door for it. But yeah, I think there's a little bit of surprise from that side when you look at the idea that the conversations are ongoing about what the future of golf is going to look like, and it doesn't seem like it's one ecosystem now.
Rex, there isn't any kind of conventional appeals process here. It's simply a case of you're denied, you can kind of tweak your format and then come back and submit another application which might be looked upon more favourably. But is this actually fixable for LIV, given that there does seem to be an issue with the team format coexisting side by side with the individual play and the very nature of LIV itself, which is designed to be this kind of closed, small ecosystem of elite players at the top of the game?
I think you mentioned the LIV event that was in Orlando a few months ago and the sort of the issues they're going to have with that. If you have a player whose team outcome is more on his mind than the individual outcome, it's going to corrupt whatever happens in the individual competition, and therefore it's going to corrupt whatever would possibly happen with the world ranking points. I think that's a problem. I don't think it's the problem. When you look at what Peter Dawson, and certainly what he told the Global Golf Post today, they can figure out a way, the world ranking can figure out a way mathematically to sort of filter some of these things out, to look into the idea that it's only 54 holes, that it's only 48-man fields. They can make the adjustments for that. The bigger issue is the quote-unquote closed shop. I think as of right now, you only have four players that are going to be able to play their way on to that circuit. And the way the teams are established, you have sort of the principal of each team. They're going to decide who they want to play with and who they have on their team. It's hard to come up with a scenario that you would have a quote-unquote full Q school like the PGA Tour has, where you would have that churn rate was a big deal on the PGA Tour over the last few months. We're talking about going into next year's schedule. You're never going to have that if each team is going to decide who their four players are. I think that's going to be the bigger issue long-term.
And a lack of Monday qualifying as well. Rex, we appreciate the time. Look for your reporting on golfchannel.com.
Thanks, guys.
All right, folks, take a look at the timeline. LIV Golf and the official World Golf Ranking. Last summer, LIV submits the application to receive the world ranking points, included entire roster of LIV golfers writing a letter to Peter Dawson calling for points awarded immediately and retroactively to June. Then in August of 2022, Greg Norman writes in a letter to LIV players that the OWGR is severely compromised without LIV's inclusion. October of last year, LIV forms strategic alliance with Middle East and North Africa Tour in an effort to secure official World Golf Ranking points. December of last year, the OWGR announces that Mexican Professional Golf Tour will begin to earn points in January, LIV status still undetermined. In May of this year, Seth Waugh of the PGA of America says the OWGR and LIV have been collegial in their discussions, though OWGR hadn't heard from LIV in weeks. And today, LIV's application for OWGR points is turned down. And here's Peter Dawson on the future of LIV if LIV could find a way to come up with a more open competition style and relegation. We would certainly consider that. There should be many more vacancies than perhaps there are. I don't think it's fair to the other 24 eligible tours and the thousands of players trying to get a start each week. When you look at this story, is this a case where LIV just did not check enough boxes to be deemed official world golf ranking worthy?
LIV didn't have any intent or interest in checking the boxes. And Greg Norman was very clear on that from the outset. They wanted the established criteria to essentially be passed over and to award them points for what they wanted to do. And you're going to hear this conversation a lot, and you're going to hear it from LIV players in Jeddah, that the players of quality who play there, the Dustin Johnsons of the world, guys like that, if they're not sufficiently ranked high in the rankings, it's somehow the rankings themselves are problematic. And you can take a look at where some of the top LIV guys have fallen to. Right now, Dustin Johnson all the way down to 121st. You can see the two guys on the left, Cam Smith and Brooks Koepka, are probably the most competitively relevant of the LIV guys right now. But those individual guys don't matter. It's entirely irrelevant to the discussion. What matters is the competitive integrity of the tour that they are playing on. And as Rex just pointed out, there are many caveats to the format of LIV Golf that just simply don't allow the tour to be taken seriously from a competitive standpoint, including when you have individual players in individual competition prioritizing the team component of it and making their competitive decisions on how they're playing based on protecting the lead in a team event. It's a complicated process. If this tour met the criteria for world ranking points, there is no reason why it ought not to be given world ranking points, but it doesn't. They simply don't want to face the decision or the consequences of the business decision they've all made.
I love the analogy that Rex Hoggard made, though, about this being maybe the tip of the iceberg and the fact that Yasser Al-Rumayyan, the PIF chairman, was playing golf last week at the Alfred Dunhill Links with the CEO of the RNA, Martin Slumbers, with Peter Dawson, the chairman of the official World Golf Ranking. Does that tell us that perhaps there are some more shoes to drop? This is one decision, yes, but as we are in the midst of this framework agreement discussions ongoing, who knows where this could end up? Who knows when we might see a Brooks Koepka alongside a Jason Day in a non-major championship situation?
I think there's certainly a lot of more shoes to drop in what's going on over the coming months and probably the next couple of years. But you'll have seen the comments that Peter Dawson made in his letter are very conciliatory.
Yes.
Towards the Saudis. He was quoted last week as saying that Yasser Al-Rumayyan is putting a lot of money into the game and that ought to be welcomed and embraced. Martin Slumbers made very similar comments during his press conference at the Open Championship as the CEO of the RNA. They are lining up to burrow into the trough of Saudi money. They do not wish to alienate the Saudis, but this was a step too far that they couldn't simply throw the criteria out the window and award LIV points. They would like to, but they can't do it. But they don't wish to alienate him in case they lose out on their share of the money.
What does that tell you then? That ultimately that it's this...
The normalization process is continuing.
This is cash is king.
Yes, cash is king. And it doesn't matter if you're machine-gunning migrants at the border. If you're the Saudi government and you're willing to put money into the game, you ought to be welcomed. That is simply the message that's been told here.
Yeah, and still many more shoes to drop as this story continues to unfold. We will follow it as the days and weeks wear on. Still ahead on Golf Today, an LPGA Tour card on the line over the weekend. Kristen Gilman delivered the clutch finish of a lifetime. How about going birdie eagle to make it back to the LPGA Tour? She joins us next.